Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns to the program on April 9th. Indivisible Charlottesville is dedicated to resisting the Trump agenda. They focus on national issues in Virginia's 5th Congressional District. With us in studio this morning are David Singerman. David lives in Charlottesville and is a visiting scholar in the program in the American Studies at UVA. He's an historian who specializes in the sugar industry and published an op-ed piece in the New York Times in September about the industry's long record of manipulating scientific research. He's volunteered for progressive campaigns since high school and started a Students for Howard Dean group as an undergrad. And Corinne Casey. Corinne lives in the south of Charlottesville in Batesville with her husband and two young children. Before turning to mothering full-time 4 years ago, Corinne worked as a program manager for a local environmental consulting firm. She has a master's degree in environmental leadership from Naropa University. When not chasing her kids, she works part-time as a life coach and freelance writer. Helping to start Indivisible Charlottesville is her first foray into political organizing. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks very much.
Nice to be here.
I wanted to, first of all, begin by congratulating you and your organization on your big win on Friday. What can you give us a little background on that and tell us what happened?
Sure. David? So on Friday, as many of your listeners will know, the House Republicans and the Trump administration abandoned their efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is something that they had been the kind of core of the Republican platform dating back to even before the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010. It had been the centerpiece of their campaigns, saying that Obamacare or the ACA was destroying the American healthcare system, was causing premiums to rise, was all sorts of things that turned out to be that were clear at the time were the opposite of the truth. And it turned out that running on lies is a really bad platform for governing. And when they got into power, somewhat unexpectedly in November 2016, they immediately ran into some trouble, trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And the last couple of months, we've seen, massive protests by groups like Indivisible and others, which have really pointed out how the Republicans' bill was a giant tax cut for the rich disguised as a healthcare bill, and the Republicans couldn't keep it up. And on Friday, after many kind of failed attempts to bring it to the floor, and getting conservative Republicans like our own Tom Garrett around here, who thought it wasn't conservative enough, wasn't destructive enough to the healthcare system, and moderate Republicans who were worried that it would take 24 million take healthcare, excuse me, away from 24 million Americans. Couldn't square that circle and gave up. And so the Affordable Care Act for the moment seems to be safe. And we can everybody who depends on that for their healthcare can breathe a sigh of relief for the moment.
Corinne, anything to add?
Yeah, I would just say that what's been happening, as far as our local Indivisible chapter and all across the country, the Indivisible movement and other progressive movements, came together to let our congresspeople know how much we depend on the Affordable Care Act. And we've been holding protests and also calling and writing our congresspeople. And from what I can tell, it was really those efforts by millions of people around this country showing up and letting our congresspeople know how important this is to us that allowed it to fail and for us to keep our health care. So that felt like a huge success on all of our parts.
I think that's really important to emphasize. It can't be emphasized enough. Some people have talked about the defeat of the Republicans' healthcare bill as I saw one person calling it a sort of triumph for reality that you can't just take healthcare away from 24 million Americans. But the fact is, if you control Congress, you can do almost anything you want unless people know about it, unless people object. And so, what really torpedoed this bill and made it impossible for Republicans to overhaul it. What has given it popularity ratings of, I think the latest poll that I saw said that only 17% of the country was in favor of this bill and well over 50% was opposed to it. What really made it impossible for them to pass this bill and force them to abandon something that they had run on for, you know, for 7 years was massive, organized resistance by groups like ours and across the country. And so it really was people showing up at town halls, people calling their members of Congress, people writing in, people telling their stories to the media. That's what stopped this bill, not some legislative maneuvering.
And so, the resistance is pleased, of course. Do you think that this is a major blow to the Trump agenda? Do you think this will knock them off their balance for a little bit?
I hope so. I hope so. That's what you read in the media right now, that this was their first step forward and that if this was sabotaged, it could derail the rest of the agenda. I think more importantly, what it says to us is we can do this. If we stand up, we stand indivisible, we come together, and we let our voices be heard and our stories shared, we can stop whatever they put forward. And so for us, regardless of how they take this, what it means for Americans is that democracy can work when we use it. And that's really exciting and inspiring to have our first big test of whether or not the ACA would be taken away, which I think when Trump was elected, it was sort of assumed that that's what was going to happen, because now Republicans held both houses and they'd been saying since 2010 that they were going to take it away the first chance they got. And so it felt like a mountain that maybe we wouldn't, you know, maybe we wouldn't reach the top of in trying to protect it. And yet we did. So that's really exciting.
And when you got the news on Friday, were you surprised?
It had been in the wind, you know, but I think I was nervous all day and unsure. I mean, you never know, right? You just never know. So I felt I had some hope and I didn't want to give it too much confidence. You know, I didn't want to get too much into that camp until we got word, but man, it was the thrill.
David, did you have something?
Well, I was going to say that, you talked about getting the news on Friday and I feel like there wasn't actually a moment where I got the news. I was sort of following the whole thing on Twitter, you know, second by second. But it also reflects what Corinne was saying, that it wasn't a kind of momentary thing. They actually wound up not having a vote at all. It wasn't like it was defeated on the floor. They didn't have the vote because Speaker Paul Ryan didn't have enough votes to pass the bill. And so it's very rare that they'll sort of put a bill out on the floor that they know is going to get defeated. They'll just kind of pull it in advance. But it wasn't a kind of momentary defeat. It was something that had been building for months and months and months. And so, as Corinne was saying, on November 9th, everybody thought that the Affordable Care Act was really toast. And it's been this slow building or gradual but incessant building of resistance in various forms since November 9th that has led to this point. And I think with each passing day since then, it had seemed more likely. With each passing day since the election, after the first kind of couple of weeks when progressives were just in a sort of stupor and, you know, just on a kind of all liquid diet, with each passing day, it had seemed less likely to me that the repeal would succeed, because the practical difficulties with repealing it had mounted and become more apparent. And you could see that happening to the Republicans, right? You could see Trump would come out a couple of weeks ago and say, wow, I never knew healthcare could be so complicated. And it's like, well, all of us knew that, right? And only if you run on a platform of fabrications about how simple it is and how devious Obamacare was, would you think otherwise? And so I think it had been a slowly building thing that I was trying to be cautiously optimistic about it, but even on Thursday night, when Tom Perriello held his town hall here, which a lot of the questions revolved around healthcare, I think even at that moment, people were still thinking that the Republicans would be able to pass it out of the House and repeal it. So it was still a nice feeling to have it voted down on Friday.
10 minutes after the hour, David Singerman and Corinne Casey here with us in studio this morning. You're listening to Resistance Radio 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking about their organization, Indivisible Charlottesville. With that, I'd like to move on to talking about the Indivisible organization. The first question I have is, where did the name come from? Nobody knows?
Well, the kind of founding document was this guide, the Indivisible Guide, which circulated, I think, originally as a Google Doc in sort of late November, and it was written by a few former congressional staffers, including one of Tom Perriello's staffers when he was on the Hill. And it was very clearly modeled as a way to kind of appropriate the tactics that had worked so well for the Tea Party in 2009, 2010 in resisting the Affordable Care Act at the beginning, appropriating that for progressive ends and saving the ACA. And I'm sure we'll talk later, I think, about the what's in that guide. But as far as I know, that's where the name came from and where,
right.
But where they got it, I don't know.
Right. In reading the guide, what becomes just the word indivisible, the further along we get down this path of resistance, the more powerful the word indivisible becomes for me. And I think for us, and I think I really don't know why they chose it specifically, but it would seem like if we all stand together indivisible, we can't be defeated. And it's a really powerful, vision of people coming together who won't be pulled apart by picking on differences, but are standing together in the face of the Trump administration and what they would like to see happen.
And what are the kind of basic tenets of the organization? Things like basic decency, civil liberties. What are the other sort of base tenets of the organization?
Well, there are. From what I can remember in the guide, there are these general, there's the first premise, which is we need to resist the Trump agenda. What the ideas that Donald Trump ran on, will take this country back. They are racist and bigoted and, discriminatory in many ways, and that we need to promote the American values that we all share of tolerance, inclusion, acceptance. And I think what we keep coming back to is right now, and this is what the guide says, we're on the defense. So what the Trump administration puts forward, if it's in conflict with the American values that we hold and know to be who we are and what this country is about, we need to stand up and we need to come forward and let our Congress know that that's not the type of country that we live in and what we want to see happening.
And now that the ACA is safe for now, at least,
right.
What is the next big issue that the organization from a national level is going to become involved in?
Well, as Corinne was saying, we've been, we locally and we as Indivisible, nationally have been, emphasizing the sort of defensive nature of the actions that we're taking, right? I mean, progressives don't control any branches of government at the national level. And so articulating a specific progressive policy agenda, at this point is not going to get us anywhere. What's important now is protecting the accomplishments of the last 8 years and frankly, the last 80 years, right? All of which are under threat from this, incredibly regressive administration that we've got. So I think the next, in the kind of short to medium term, the next set of actions for Indivisible will also be defensive and will depend on what the Trump administration does. So we've tried to be somewhat nimble in reacting to what they've done. So healthcare obviously has been the biggest thing for the last few months, but in the first couple of weeks when the administration issued those really inhumane orders about immigration and refugees, it was Indivisible groups that mobilized some of the resistance to that. And so if we can look forward a little bit, and I know believing the Trump administration is always a risky business, but what they say they're going to do next is push tax reform, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires as they often do. And I suspect that that will be the place that there's a lot of resistance coming up next.
And so does the organization react in a sort of a crowdsourced kind of way, or does somebody decide what we're going to look at next, or do you just watch what people are tweeting and it gets momentum that way? How does an issue come to the forefront in Indivisible's agenda?
Well, on a national level, I'm not sure how they do that, although they do. I'm sure they're tracking legislation and seeing what's coming before the House. What the guide says is we will be most effective in contacting our representatives when we're talking to them about issues that they're dealing with right now. So whatever legislation is right before them, that's what we want to be responding to and talking about. So on a national level, I imagine that they're really paying attention to that and tracking that. For locally, we're basically doing a similar type thing in that we're really paying attention to what the administration is doing and how people are responding to it and growing and moving with that, in addition to holding sort of the ACA, like David said, we've been focused on out of the gate, coming back to that again and again. And then when the immigration stuff came up, we incorporated that in as well. And I think that's what we'll continue to do, just respond to what's arising immediately and holding a longer term sense of, like, tax reform, you know, these bigger threats that may be ongoing things that we're working on.
You know, it's remarkable to think that the nomination of a Supreme Court justice could sort of fly under the radar. I mean, in a normal political year, that would be the biggest political story, and everything in Washington and all the kind of national level politics around the country would stop, and everyone would be watching, you know, Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, you know, every day on C-SPAN. But such is the torrent of garbage that is coming out of Washington these days that the nomination of Neil Gorsuch has actually flown under the radar. And so that's one of the issues in which we here locally have tried to get out in front. So last weekend or 2 weekends ago, recently. Last weekend. Time is flying in this administration. Last weekend, we held a kind of citizens hearing for Neil Gorsuch, and we had some Dahlia Lithwick, who's a prominent national legal commentator who lives in the area, and an assistant Commonwealth attorney in Charlottesville, both spoke about the impact that a Justice Gorsuch would have on constitutional liberties and criminal justice. And that was, you know, a way to get a little bit ahead of it, because he hasn't come to a Senate vote yet, but we would like Senators Warner and Kaine to, you know that people in Charlottesville are and in the 5th District are opposed to this nomination.
We have just a minute or so before we need to break. One thing that question that always comes to my mind about this is this tremendous uprising of people that are opposed to the Trump agenda. Where were these people on Election Day? What happened?
Yeah, I don't know where they were, but I think what happened after the election, and I guess I can just speak for myself, was there was this idea that suddenly the country, I think slowly what's been happening, what we've seen over Obama's 8 years, was for me personally, when Obama was elected, I thought we were headed for the golden age, you know?
Yeah,
and I,
sure.
And I stepped down from my paying attention, my engagement, my being involved. And I, you know, Obama's got it, and I'm going to raise my kids, you know? There was this growing sense of, like, it doesn't really seem like the government's working that well. Like, it doesn't seem like it's working, but Obama is president, so it's okay. Yeah. You know, and then there was this, and for me, it just felt like the possibility that Trump would be our president was so utterly impossible. It couldn't come to be. And what happened the morning after his election was this sort of, sense of not knowing what country I lived in and what was going on. And I think a lot of Americans felt that all of a sudden. And the response to that was, we need to get involved. The government is in our hands and we need to claim it. And so that's where the uprising came from.
After the break, we'll talk about the Charlottesville chapter of Indivisible. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Resistance Radio 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with David Singerman and Corinne Casey from Indivisible Charlottesville. David, did you want to add something to that last, what we're just talking about?
Yeah, you just asked where all these people were on election day. And I think that the answer is they were probably voting, right? When we had our town hall, Indivisible Charlottesville had a town hall at the Charlottesville High School at the end of February, you know, over 1,200 people showed up. And if I had to guess, I would guess that, you know, almost everyone in that room and probably everyone in that room had voted on election day. But they hadn't done sort of more than that, or they might have done a little bit more. But they hadn't, I'm sure they hadn't come to a town hall before. They might not have volunteered for a campaign. They might not have given money. They might not have phone banked or knocked on doors. When I was at the Women's March in D.C., you know, the day after Election Day, I looked around and I saw, or the day after the inauguration, I sort of looked around the mall and saw 500,000 people there. And it made me realize that none of those people were going to stop. Right, with this march, right? They were all going to go home and do more than they had done before. And there were 3.5 million people around the country at these marches who were going to go home and up their game, basically, politically, right? Get involved, get one more level involved or two more levels involved than they had been before. And it struck me at that moment that that is a really, like, extraordinary amount of political energy to harness. And so that was something that has really stuck with me. It made me think about what a demonstration is, like literally the word demonstration.
Right.
It's kind of like a peacock's tail, right? It doesn't serve any kind of functional purpose. It just sort of shows off how much energy you have to do something with. And so a march itself, getting 500,000 people together in one space doesn't actually change policies in any way. But what it does is it tells leaders who are in office, the people who can make policy, like, look how much energy we have to burn, right? We can do this thing that doesn't actually have any effect on its own. Imagine what we'll do when it actually matters.
Yes, because I was thinking that the Women's March really doesn't follow the Indivisible strategy, because it doesn't target specific congresspersons. But I see what you're saying. It shows who's out there and what they're capable of.
Yeah. There was a headline, I think the next day in some, maybe it was in New York Magazine, that said, like, the progressive resistance to the Trump administration has already begun, right? And if you think about the Bush administration, it took, you know, until 2004, 2005, for a real kind of progressive resistance to form, to the Bush administration. And that led relatively quickly to, you know, the 2006 gains in the House and in the Senate for Democrats. And the fact that the Trump administration had been in office for like 18 hours when the resistance formed meant that it was going to be rough sailing for them from the beginning. And that's what we've seen. I mean, I think that more, you know, less sort of focused demonstrations like the Women's March, which wasn't directly targeting a particular member of Congress or on a particular issue, it served a really valuable purpose for, I don't know, for me, right? Which was that it made me feel great about doing this, right? I mean, everybody was in such a terrible mood, understandably, between November and January 20th. And for the week after the Women's March, everybody was kind of bouncing around, and you could see that people had a spring in their step. And I think that that's a really valuable function of the kind of work that the groups like ours have been doing, just getting people together in the same place with people who feel the same way as they do. It brings people back to do it.
Right. And I think what else it did was get a lot of media attention that got a lot of it reached a lot of people who are maybe, I know friends that I had around the country who are maybe tuned out, and all of a sudden they saw this media coverage of tons of people showing up together saying, no way. And then they got the message of kind of like, oh, wait, we're not going to sit back and have this be business as usual. Like, we can actually do, like, there are tons of people who want to do something about this. How can I get involved? And I think that's where the Indivisible guy just sort of dovetailed perfectly into it, because then you come back from that march, or you come back from those sort of show up opportunities, and then it's like, well, what can I really do? And the Indivisible Guide lays out this strategy of direct action that you can take to bring about effective change. And it's very simple and very doable, and actually results in something different happening at the end.
And something that you said, that Dan, you'd asked a while earlier, was whether this defeat on the Obamacare repeal was really going to derail the Trump agenda in some way. And one of the ways that it does, one of the really profound ways that it does, is that it shows progressives, it shows groups like Indivisible, the people who showed up to the Women's March, that it really can make a difference. And so, that also will empower people to come back and keep fighting. And it's not going to get any easier for the administration from here forward.
I'd like to move on now, if we could, to the Charlottesville chapter of Indivisible. Let's start at the beginning. How did it get started?
Well, the way it got started was there was a couple of, so we discovered the Indivisible Guide, a bunch of different people. And then in my case, it was my sister and one friend of ours decided, okay, this is what we want to do. We've never taken political action before. I've never been involved. This guide makes total sense to us. We're going to start a group. We'll probably have 10 of our friends join us, and we'll follow it to a T. And so our friend went onto the Indivisible Guide website, and that was the first step to sort of register your group there to let your community know that you're getting started. And up until that point, there had been nothing happening in Charlottesville. And over that weekend, when our friend registered, two other groups popped up in Charlottesville as well. And so there was contact information there. We sent around an email saying, hey, we all want to start this group. Let's get together and see if we can do it. We'd never met each other before. We sat down at a bar together and talked about it, and then we just took off from there. We decided to have our first meeting, our kickoff meeting, and we got a Facebook page and advertised it up there. And on January 28th, we had a room booked at the library downtown, and we overflowed out of it by hundreds and had to move down to the Haven. And How many people was it that showed up to that first meeting? I mean, there was a huge upwelling of interest in the guide.
So when you got together with the two other Indivisible groups that were kind of getting started, it must have been like everybody was coming home, sort of, in a way. I mean, you come together, you have common interests, and you really want to do this thing.
Yeah, it was exciting. You know, yeah. I mean, it felt like... We had no idea, or at least I speak for myself, I had no idea at that point that it was going to become as big as it did. I thought, I felt really excited to have people who were clearly as passionate and convicted about what needed to happen as I was. And so that felt like a relief. I think one thing that the Indivisible movement has really, one thing that it's given us is a sense that we're not alone in feeling the way that we feel. And that's been really important for me, to know that there are lots of people that feel like I do. Yeah.
David, how did you come to the group?
Similarly, I think there were two, three, four, maybe even five different like Indivisible, of those little Indivisible groups in Charlottesville at the very beginning. And one of my friends happened to have started one, and she said, do you want to get involved with this? And so I came to one of the initial kind of set up meetings at a coffee shop. And that was just the week before right after the inauguration. So we were planning that meeting on the 28th and kind of divided up roles. And very few of us had met each other before.
Right.
So I, you know, came on board that way.
David Singerman and Corinne Casey here in studio with us this morning on Resistance Radio 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking about their organization, Indivisible Charlottesville. I want to move on now to focus to what you're mainly involved in, and that is the 5th District. We're going to talk about the Indivisible Guide later, and we're going to talk about how it directs your efforts to specific members of Congress, more specifically, your member of Congress. For people who don't know, Charlottesville is in the 5th District, and our representative in the House of Representatives is a Republican by the name of Tom Garrett. Tom is in a fairly safe seat, I would think we can say that. It's only been held by a Democrat one other time in the last decade or so. How do you reach somebody, a congressperson like Tom Garrett, who is in a, I don't want to use the word gerrymandered, but he's, let's just say he's in a safe seat. How do you reach a person like that?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that I don't want to give too strong of an impression of how safe a seat it was. His margin in 2016 was substantial, but the districts have been drawn in a way, to statewide, the state legislature, the last time that it drew these districts, it was under Republican control. And so it drew most of the districts in Virginia in such a way as to maximize the number of Republicans who would be, in Congress. But the way you do that is not by kind of cramming all the Republicans into one district, but by spreading them so that you have a reasonable margin in as many districts as you can. So it's not a district that leans or that is inevitably going to be Republican by 15 or 20 points every election. And so in the kind of wave election that you saw in 2008 or in 2006 or on the other side in 2010, it is the kind of district that would flip, which is to say that efforts at putting pressure on Tom Garrett are really meaningful, right? Are really not futile at all, which is something that you might be afraid of if you looked at a map of the district and saw kind of all the red splotches all over it. And the question of how to put pressure on him, you appeal to him as constituents, right? I mean, he's a politician for part of his job, and he has partisan interests that he's after in national. You know, the national party sets the agenda in a lot of ways, but constituents are constituents, and he represents us.
I want to move on now to talk a little bit about the town hall meeting that y'all held, I think, February 26th. Is that right?
I think so.
Certainly near the end of February. First of all, probably a lot of our listeners have never been to a town hall meeting. What is a town hall meeting, and what made this one different than most of them?
Well, I'd never been to a town hall meeting before this one either.
Me neither. But
my understanding of a town hall, the way it's supposed to work when your congressperson does show up, is that it's really a listening opportunity for the congresspeople, that it's a time when they come back home to their district, they show up, they invite their constituents in, and they listen to what concerns they have about what's going on in their country right now. In our case, our congressman didn't schedule a town hall. And so due to how dire and extreme the fear was around here, around the repeal of ACA and what was happening with the Trump administration, when he didn't honor our request to set one up, we scheduled one for him. And we scheduled it initially, and then we found out that he was going to be out of town. So we changed it to a date when he would be around. And we invited him to come, and we invited constituents of the 5th District to show up, and we went from there.
And which of those two showed up, the congressperson or the members of the 5th District?
Members of the 5th.
In droves, I understand. How many people attended?
We had ambitions to counting exactly, and then that quickly fell apart when we saw people streaming in. But the MLK Auditorium at the high school seats over 1,200, and there were people sitting in the aisles and on the stairs. Well over 1,200 people, I think mm-hmm. came.
I thought it was interesting that you chose students to moderate the the town hall. Where did that idea come from?
That idea, I don't remember exactly where it came from, but we wound up working closely with the Amnesty International group at the high school, which has, I think, 30 or 40 students in it, quite a number of students. And one of the students who moderated the event, Gibridi, had gotten sort of national attention because he's the president of his senior class and came to the U.S. as a refugee himself 5 years ago. I think he'd met Tom Garrett when Garrett came to their high school, and we hadn't met him before. Certainly I hadn't met him before, but by all accounts, he was a really kind of level-headed, engaging person, and just the kind of person that we wanted to help run an event like that.
And did those attending, did they get a chance to ask the empty Tom Garrett chair a question?
Yes. Yes, they did. The way that we wanted to set it up was basically as if he was there, except he wouldn't be answering the questions. So we chose a couple of big topics, and then we had on record information about where Garrett stood on the ACA and immigration and education, and those were sort of our three big topics. And we, our moderators would open up by reading a brief statement about what Garrett had put forward to the public on those issues, and then we opened the floor and constituents stood up, shared their stories, asked their questions. We recorded everything and delivered it to Garrett's office afterward. And the whole point was for constituents' voices to be heard and to really try and reach him that way.
We have a brief clip of one of those speakers that we've brought in today, a gentleman talking about immigration and racism. It runs about a minute and 30 seconds. So I'm going to like to listen to that now. We can chat about it in a minute.
Hello. My name's Simon, and I'm an immigrant. I'm also now a citizen. I come from a country, as some of you can tell, that is pretty popular here for the most part. We gave you Downton Abbey and the beginnings of democracy. So I've met with pretty much nothing but welcome here and help and encouragement and people's kindness. What I want to ask is, as an immigrant who's received that, please explain to me how the measures that are now being taken or attempted against refugees and citizens from Muslim countries and also from our friends south of the border, how they are anything but naked racism.
Good question.
Is he right? Is he right?
Is he right that there's nothing but naked racism behind this?
Yeah.
I don't want to impugn the motives of people who voted for Donald Trump, but I think it is clear that Donald Trump and the people he surrounds himself with are motivated by what we used to call like white supremacy in a lot of different ways. And in fact, the courts are agreeing with us right on this. The office of the president has enormous latitude to enact orders related to immigration that can't be unconstitutional, and they've been struck down by the courts so far because of the things that candidate Donald Trump said about banning Muslims from this country. And it seems clear that the immigration orders that have been passed so far by Donald Trump or that have been issued so far by Donald Trump and masterminded by people like Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller, are really motivated by a really retrograde belief in what kind of person you have to be counted as an American.
After the break, we'll talk more about Indivisible Charlottesville and their plans for the future. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Resistance Radio 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with David Singerman and Karen Casey from Indivisible Charlottesville. I want to talk now about where we go from here, where the resistance movement goes from here, where Indivisible Charlottesville goes from here. And I want to talk about it from the perspective of the Indivisible, the document, Indivisible, a practical guide to resisting the Trump agenda. This is a document that galvanized the resistance movement. Is that fair to say?
I think so. It certainly told us what to do, right? Because We were talking earlier about the sort of dozen or so people who got together to organize Indivisible Charlottesville, and none of us had any organizing experience, and you know, not much sort of organized political experience in any way. But we knew we had to do something. And what was so valuable about this Indivisible Guide was, as the subtitle said, it's a practical guide for making your member of Congress listen to you and resisting the Trump agenda. And I think that that practical advice was as useful as anything.
It seems that the main tenet of the guide is to act locally, that the resistance, their biggest road to success is to influence their own congressperson, not the congressperson from another district or not the president directly. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. I think what David was saying earlier about Tom Garrett, his seat not being guaranteed for him for any length of time is important to keep in mind. I mean, what the guide is laying out is that our Congress people are always concerned about reelection. That's always something that's on their mind. And that it, what the guide said is that if your group shows up twice a month at your congressperson's office, you are the group that's most active, that they are hearing the most from. And so, that's what you want to do. Make yourself known, a known entity. Whether or not we can change his actions, we can't really control, but we can be a presence that he's aware of and that he knows there's going to be backlash from.
And is a part of it, I mean, I know this sounds kind of crude in a way, but is it part of it just keeping him busy so that they can't, you know, enact more legislation that would be harmful?
I would say that keeping the, insofar as the town halls and the Indivisible organized protests across the country have kept healthcare, you know, in the news, that has been really useful in keeping the Republicans who control the, you know, the Congress from doing all sorts of other terrible stuff. Not that they haven't managed to do it, and it is actually one of the troubling things that bills have slipped under the radar that are quite scary over the last couple of weeks. But yeah, I think that protests and showing up at your congressperson's office does have a role in concentrating their attention.
And it's not just about the congressman who disagrees with you. I think the guide talks extensively about supporting your mm-hmm. congressperson
right.
who is doing good things.
Right.
And again, some people may not know, but both of Virginia's senators are Democrats. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm hearing from and I understand from reading the guide is that energy needs to be spent telling them that they're on the right track too.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. I think with what David was saying earlier about our Gorsuch event around that was focused on our senators, and in the same way that we are, you know, maybe a more looming or negative weight on Garrett's shoulders as far as our senators, the presence we would like to have is really empowering them to take a stand quickly and firmly, knowing that they have the support of many, many of their constituents who are calling on them to do that. And I think when you look at the way that the Democratic Party is responding to Gorsuch as a nominee now, they're getting firmer and being confident about filibustering. Like, I think in the same way that the ACA was stymied by resistance, the Democrats can be really liberated and supported by having a really active voice of people saying, this is what we want. And also, we are really, if you don't do this, then that's not good either. You know, like really supporting them and also trying to guide them in that way of like, this is what we want the Democratic Party to look like.
Right. And is it true that for most congresspersons, their biggest concern is getting reelected? Is that a motivating factor?
Say for almost all members of Congress, almost all the time, what they're weighing is whether the vote they're about to take, the event they're about to attend will help them get reelected or hurt them. That is a really huge motivation, especially since elections are every 2 years, but that means that campaigns, you know, start 8 to 10 months or 12 months in advance. So there's a window of a couple of months, I would say, after they're elected and after they're sworn into office, where they can feel like they can kind of skate by. And one of the things that's about to happen is that over the next few months, that window will close, and Republican members of Congress will get even more skittish about re-election, and that will put a brake on the Trump agenda even more.
And when does the 5th District, when does Tom Garrett go up for election next?
2018.
2018, not that far away, really,
not
is it?
All.
I mean, he'll start campaigning late this year, probably, even?
I mean, I would say he's already campaigning, right?
Yeah.
You'll see him doing photo ops, you know, at hospitals and things like that. And the way to understand those is as campaign events as much as anything else.
And will Indivisible try to motivate people to attend these events, these campaign events?
That's what the guide encourages. Basically, the guide says anytime your congressperson is in your district, see that as an opportunity to show up and ask him tough questions and not let him get away, whether it's a ribbon cutting or anything, but be present, be there, and try and get him to answer questions.
And if somebody wanted to know where the next protest was, how do they hook up with you guys through social networks and so on?
Sure. So we have a very active Facebook page. I think it's just facebook.com/indivisiblecharlottesville, but you could certainly find it if you search for it. And you'll also find a link there to sign up for our email list. And we're on Twitter at indivisiblevA05.
We'll put links to both of those on the podcast version of this program as well. What are the sort of things that your congressman doesn't care about, besides what people in other districts think about? I mean, what are wasted efforts with regard to your congressman? David?
Well, to put it a little bit differently, maybe the more effort that goes into an action, right, the more it counts. To go back to what I think I was getting at earlier about the value of a demonstration, right? The more action it takes, the more effort it takes to do something that relates to your congressman, the more that they are going to understand your commitment to it and your willingness to do to take action that will matter to them when it comes to the election. So you know, tweeting at your congressman is easy but kind of low effort, and they understand it to be low effort, right? Sending an email is also is better, but not as effective. Sending a letter is good. Making a phone call is good. And the thing that matters the most, I think, and the thing that will make a congressperson listen the most is showing up in person. And whether that's, to their office, or whether it's finding them at some event, those are the kind of actions that, that can really make a difference. So the more in-person stuff you can do, the better.
David Singerman and Corinne Casey here with us in studio this morning on Resistance Radio 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking about their organization, Indivisible Charlottesville. Sorry, David, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to add one last thing, which is you don't have to wait for us as Indivisible to organize an opportunity for you to visit your congressman, right? Tom Garrett has an office up on Berkmar Circle, right off Ryle Road. It's open 9 to 5. He's a public official. It's your right to go petition your member of Congress. So if you're in the area, if you're at Lowe's for something, or you're at Walmart, just stop by, say hello, get to know the staff, leave a little comment for him. It just takes a couple of minutes. And if, as Karim was saying, if a dozen people do that every day, that is actually an enormous increase over what a congressperson's office normally gets, and they will notice.
I want to talk a little bit about calling. I've noted that you've said that calling is not as good as showing up, but as a second goodness thing, it's something that's very easy to do. When you call your congressman, tell us what happens when you call your congressman's office. How will you be received? How does it work?
Well, if you're calling Tom Garrett, if you're going to get through, someone will just pick up the phone usually and say, Tom Garrett's office. How can I help you? And at that point, what I've found it's helpful to do, because again, this is something that I just started doing. I'd never called my congressperson before Trump was elected, and I started doing it immediately after, and was a little bit nervous about it, because you're really on the spot. So I would just, I'd write down, you know, what the issue is that I want to call about, and then have that right in front of me. And then they pick up the phone and say, how can I help you? And you say, I'm a constituent of Tom Garrett's. This is my zip code. I'm calling about this issue. And you let them know what it is. And they take it down and say, thank you. I'll share that with the congressman. And it's as simple as that. And it actually feels really good to do that. I think one of the things that the Indivisible Guide collectively tapped into was this idea that when we vote, that's not the only political action that we can take, that our representatives, part of their job is to be accessible to us and to hear our voices. They work for us, literally. And so taking that, I call Senator Kaine, Senator Warner, Congressman Garrett regularly throughout the week, and just as like a muscle strengthening exercise, so that I feel confident doing it, and they know that I'm right here watching
right.
what they're doing.
Right.
And it can be a little bit intimidating at first, but really the people sitting in those offices are very nice. And that's their job, to take down what you have to say and to share it with your congressperson.
And do you have to identify yourself when you call?
Sometimes they ask for your name. I don't think you are required by law to give it, but it is helpful to give your address and your zip code so that they know that you are actually one of their constituents. Because what the guide emphasizes around that is they really only care about hearing from their constituents, and that's where the most power comes from. So making sure that they know that you are actually in their district is really helpful.
One thing that's I'll come back to you in a second, David, but one thing that I saw near the top of the Indivisible Guide that surprised me was it said, you don't have to just be a U.S. citizen to do this, that people with permanent resident status, even undocumented residents, are and should be a part of the process as well. That kind of surprised me.
I mean, I think that's right, although only U.S. citizens, of course, can vote.
Mm-hmm.
Permanent residents, people on work visas, and even as we know, right, undocumented people in the United States are a really crucial part of our communities, right? And a half decent member of Congress will care about the businesses in his district, will care about the communities in his or her district, and so hearing from those members of the community as well is should matter to any member of Congress who takes their commitment to their district seriously.
David, I interrupted you. You were going to add something to what Corinne said earlier.
I was going to say that, members of Congress care about getting reelected, right? And they care about what their constituents think. And if they don't care about what their constituents think, they are going to find themselves out of a job pretty quickly. And so what the staffs of members of Congress do is keep tallies of who's calling on what issue or how many people are calling on what issue. And so you'll hear statistics like, calls into Congress on this bill are, coming in 10-1 against or 5-1 in favor. And that's because, there are staffers who really are making lists of how many people are calling, how many constituents are calling about these issues. I was an intern in a House office a long time ago, and I remember doing this.
I'd like to talk now to listeners who've heard us talk about town hall meetings, but have never been to one themselves and don't know that it's, you see town hall meetings on TV, particularly if they're chaired by Republicans, and they can look pretty scary sometimes. I mean, people are yelling. But your town hall meeting wasn't like that at all. I mean, we played one clip. I thought that was very typical of the kind of intelligent discourse that took place at that. But I just want to ask you some general questions about how would you prepare for a town hall meeting? First of all, if you have a question, how would you, should you write it down? Should you speak off the cuff? How do you prepare a question for a town hall meeting?
Well, the first thing I would say is that you, as you mentioned, the Indivisible Guide has a lot of, and the Indivisible website has a lot of, resources for how to do this. if I were asking a question at a town hall, I would research my question in advance, right? So having a personal story about, say, healthcare or immigration, is really important. That can provide a kind of context for your question and make it more, newsworthy and also more kind of emotionally affecting. But you should also do your research about the policy and know exactly where your congressperson stands on an issue, know what issues are before Congress or what practical bills are before Congress. Write down your question. That's one thing to do. And if you go with a group of friends, one of the best pieces of advice that I've heard is spread out, right? Sit around, have everybody on the same message. Everybody's ready to ask the same question and sit not in a cluster, but around the room and all raise your hands. And that will increase the chances that one of you will be called on.
I have just a minute or so left. What about bringing signs? They seem to be very popular. Is it a good idea?
I think specifically for a town hall, is that the question? If we're going to a town hall. I think the guide recommends if you're going to a town hall not to bring signs. If you want to get called on, you might not want to identify yourself as someone who's there to ask a difficult question that the congressperson may not want to ask. So not to a town hall specifically, you want to blend in with the crowd, not bring a sign.
But I think that actually also goes to the matter of who the question in the town hall is addressed to. And in part, it should be addressed directly to the congressman. I mean, literally, it's addressed to the congressman. But the real audience for the question is voters in the district who, might be swingable, right, between the member of Congress and a challenger, right? And so you want to think about what is the question, not that's going to appeal to you and your friends and people who already agree with you, but what is the kind of story, what is the kind of question that might get people to switch votes.
Just 30 seconds left. Tom Garrett is going to have that town hall meeting. What's the date of that?
The 31st, this coming Friday.
And it is limited access, is something that you all have been fighting for. Are you organizing an event outside the meeting place?
Yeah, a number of groups at the university. So the town hall will be held at UVA. And a number of groups at the university are organizing a big festival of democracy with lots of resources for civic participation. And there will be speakers and other kinds of activities going on. But it'll be an opportunity for all the thousands of people who wanted to talk to Tom Garrett at that high school town hall, but were limited by the number of seats that he, had a lottery for. Definitely come, definitely participate. It will be a great event.
Corinne, last thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I would just encourage people to come on the 31st as well. This is our chance to stand together. He's actually going to be there, and let him see us. Let him see us standing indivisible together.
Yeah, and I would say that you can find information about that on our Facebook page as well.
David, Corinne, thanks so much for coming in. The hour went by so fast. I hope that you will consider yourself friends of WPVC and come back and see us again real soon.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You can listen to this and every episode of The Wake Up Call at cvopodcast.com. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when Sean McCord talks with Meredith Richards about the Charlottesville Democratic's Candidate Development Academy. Coming up at noon on 94.7 WPVC, it's El Club del Sabor. For the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.